Great. So what I thought I'd do today is to just talk to you about, since I haven't been to any of these prior meetings, so I don't know exactly the kinds of pieces of interface that that you're sort of interested in talking about. So what I thought I'd do is to just talk about two themes in terms of where our work is heading, and try to integrate sort of those two parts together and sort of give you a snapshot over the next period of time where we are with a few of these different projects. And I think that, you talk about being credited with, I'm not sure that certainly the idea of a cancer stem cell and a leukemia stem cell predated me by many decades. And in fact, you can look in the literature, you can find references to terminology like that going back into the 50s, actually. And credit, I'm not sure in this day and age is the thing that one would necessarily want to have attributed to oneself. Certainly, it's an area that's become quite controversial, I would say. And like any field in science, controversy is actually a good thing because it actually sharpens people's thinking and sharpens. I think that there's been far too much sort of papers that were published in very high profile papers that high profile journals that probably shouldn't have been published. And they kind of lead a life of their own. And the good thing about a controversy is that tends to, sharpens review processes and everything like that. So those are all the good things. So often, in fact, what the cancer stem cell model, which is actually very hard to accept in very large areas of cancer biology, often because it's put in mutual exclusivity with sort of the clonal evolution, genetic selection, models, which of course are very well entrenched in cancer biology, and so they're often viewed as mutually exclusive. And so what I'll talk about is what I think is actually a way of integrating, or the beginning steps of integrating these. They don't need to be viewed as mutually exclusive. And then I think this is probably the really, the fundamental sense that, our cancer stem cells, in our case leukemia stem cells, artifacts of the assays you're using, and even if they're not artifacts of those assays, and they're real in those assays, are they actually relevant in the human situation? And so we'll talk about some of that. And then how do you actually use this information, and is it valuable for anything? And so I'll just give you a couple of indicators at the end of my talk about that. So I think it's true to say the reason that we know so much more about the biology, certainly the hierarchical organization of the leukemias, is that that's been anchored on more than five decades of work at studying normal hematopoiesis. And in fact, it's the ability to move back and forth across this divide between normal and leukemia, which I think has been the critical reason why we have actually learned more about leukemia. And the reason actually has to do, it's not so much, one is of course just ways of thinking and ways of looking at data, but it's also how one applies assays and how one interprets assays. Because the real issue is this cell really different than this cell down here? Or is it just a state that where cells are moving back and forth? And how do you interpret your assays in any particular way? Well, the same thing is true on the normal blood side. Why do we say that a cell which is committed to, the erythroid lineage down here is distinct from a cell up here? Maybe all these cells are equal, and this cell, just in its environment, is responsive to a particular set of cues, but in a different set of environments, it would actually have, stem cell potential. Well, the issue is that in five decades, people have been able to take these clonal assays and been able to infer that, in fact, no, that's not the case. That, in fact, this is a true relationship. This cell is, less committed than this cell is, down in here. And we can actually draw an arrow, and that arrow has some meaning to it, that the probability of this cell going backwards is very low. Now, in some cases, it's not zero. We know that in lymphoid development, there's a lot of plasticity here, and if you actually muck up with one transcription factor, PAX5, you can get cells that are committed to B cells blocked, and then those cells can actually enter these kinds of pathways here. So certainly at the top end, there is some flexibility, if you like, and I think I like the idea of thinking about this not as a, in a deterministic way, but more where one can apply probabilities that, it's highly likely that the information flows this way. But there are situations where you can, you know, either change the probability or you know, not every cell will there's a stochasticity, I guess I would say, in the system, and so cells can actually move down other developmental pathways. So the point of that is that by being able to infer how to, in a sense, develop assays so you can actually make these kinds of relationships has been actually very important at the conclusions that we would draw from the same when applying very similar kinds of assays to leukemia, which allowed us, I think, to, in a more reliable way, to talk about, leukemia as being a hierarchy. Now, so why am I saying that? Because I think that, you know, as many of us know, that this notion that there potentially are hierarchies in the cancers of other kinds of tumors, certain solid tumors, is been much more problematic in terms of really understanding what an assay means. How do you actually develop an assay, and how do you infer that it actually is a true hierarchy, or is it just that the assay is not very good and you're just picking cells that happen to exist in two different states, but essentially it's the same kind of cell? And I think that because we, in you know, many other systems, you know, we don't have as deep an understanding of the normal tissue architecture. And so it's been difficult to translate that across. So sort of one sort of editorial point. And then I guess the other one is that, you know, the reason we have this deep understanding of blood development and really, you know, the towering achievement of Till and McCullough in their work in the early 60s was really this notion that clonal assays matter. And the fact that we were able to infer these relationships are only true because they've been able to test the activity of single cells. And we know that a cell of this particular type, if we sort it, you take 100 cells, you put them into wells, and you look at output, you always get this kind of an output. Whereas if you take this cell and put it under the same conditions, you only get these outputs, you'll never get those outputs. And you can only infer that based on single cell assays. So why? So the reason we know all of this detail about the blood is, so two things have happened. One is the development of assays, but the other is the development of these clonal assays, which I'll talk about in a second, but the other is the ability to flow sort cells, and essentially and to take a very complex mixture of cells and to bin them based on cell surface markers, which you can pick up pure population. So you can develop sets of markers. In the blood we have, you know, more than 300 or 400 these so-called CV markers, which represent things on the surface of cells that define in very finely, fine granularity the developmental steps between some kind of an immature cell to cells of, you know, 10 or so mature lineages. And so it's to apply those markers together with flow cytometry, you can develop cells that are completely pure, and then you can ask, well, what is the function of those cells? So that's how we've inferred these kinds of assays. Now, for the most, in fact, where the blood system has gotten into a lot of trouble over the years is when people try to do this, where they take a population which is marker pure and you read out some functions. This happens to be a marker pure of a multipotential progenitor. It has lymphoid readouts and myeloid readouts, so it's a multi-lineage cell. And so you take, in this case, you know, you take 10 cells and you see that when you take those 10 cells in contrast to a different population of cells, and you see that this population always has multi-lymphoid readout and another population doesn't. And you say, well, this is, you know, this population of cells here or this population of cells here. But the problem is that that's what you want. You want that marker pure correlates with functionally pure. But what you could have if you don't have clonal assays is if you have whatever we have here, 6 cells, that cell could be making myeloid, that cell could be making B, those cells could be making that output. So these could all be marker pure. They're pure for, you know, 5 or 10 markers, but they're functionally heterogeneous. And there's no way to resolve this from this. And the only way to resolve it is by doing single cell assays. So you take 6 cells here, like of that marker pure, you drop them in wells where all options are available. And if you get, you know, single digit readout or single lineage readouts, you know that this is the situation. And if you, every cell of the 6 or 10 or 100 that you played of marker pure always read out with multilineage, then you can say that that was a true multipotential cell. So that's the whole point. And so that becomes very critical for trying to infer the activity of leukemia cell or of the architecture of leukemia hierarchies. So, and you know, so, I mean, this has been reviewed ad nauseum, but the point being that when one applies these kinds of assays to complex mixtures, you know, let me just step back and say that, I mean, of course, it's been known from the time of, you know, the great experimental pathologists of the 19th century. If you look down a microscope, yes, cancers are generally, you know, monotonous, homogeneous populations of aberrantly growing cells. But it was known even at that time, if you look down the microscope, you can see cells are big or small, they have different granularities, different shapes, you know, and all of that. So not every cell was equal, at least at kind of a gross macroscopic level. And then it became clear when people were able to develop, again, work of another, you know, great Canadian, Charles LeBlanc, developing putative thymidine labeling, where you could actually develop cell cycle analysis, that not every cell in a cancer is proliferating equally, or at least in any static analysis, not all cells are proliferating in a cancer. And, you know, you can do pulse chase experiments, and so the notion came about that there's a lot of heterogeneity of cell cycle proliferation in tumors. And so by applying then, you know, sort of the classical approaches of flow sorting, you know, the notion is that in a cancer there are cells that are unequal in their function, or they don't have equal probability at sustaining the clone. That there are some cells that have higher probability of sustaining tumor formation over long periods of time compared to other cells. And by clonal analysis, you can show that these cells are the, the cells that lack that property down here are the progeny of these cells up here. And so by carrying out clonal assays, you can actually prove that there is a population of cells like this, which is distinct from the other population. And so in that way, these cells actually possess two of the canonical properties of stem cells. That is, they can maintain themselves long-term, and they can make daughter cells not like themselves in terms of their function. And so in that way, you know, people can, and, you know, in its fundamental way, you know, this is not a cell that makes a colony in a dish. This is not a cell that proliferates. This is a cell that can regrow the tumor. Now, short of, you know, one can do syngeneic experiments in mice and say that, you know, the property of this cell is that it can remake the tumor in contrast to this cell. And in studying human cancers, of course, one is reliant on xenograft models, taking human cells and putting them in mice. But the point being that what this infers is that what's an operation, you know, it assumes that these cells are all genetically identical, and the only difference between that cell and that cell must be the operation of an epigenetic or developmental program or transcriptional program, in the same way that, you know, the reason that this cell is different than this cell is the operation of an epigenetic, you know, methylation changes in the chromatin, histones are changing, and, you know, transcription factors are growing, you know, some are active here and they go down and others become active here. So there are developmental programs that are operating that distinguish that cell from that cell. And in the same way, that's what's happening here. And so therefore, you know, people, again, an old concept that's been around from Barry Pierce, I think, had a title of a paper back in the early 1970s called Tumors Are Caricatures of Normal Development. So they're not normal development, but they retain memories, if you like, of tissues from which they came. So that's the cancer stem cell model. Now, of course, cancer is a genetic disease. There are mutations in cells. Those mutations, if they land in bad places, in the so-called hallmarks of cancer, they can give a competitive growth advantage to a cell. That causes that population to outcompete the normal cells, and it sets up the ability to, particularly if cells are growing faster or whatever, you can then acquire, you know, hit number two, gives that cell a competitive growth advantage, and so on and so forth. You know, the classical sort of Knoll hypothesis of genetic evolution or clonal evolution, where selection processes are shaping the genetic architecture, if you like, of this tumor. Now, what's become clear, I think, in the analysis of, you know, the massive amount of genetic work that's gone on over the last many decades, which is accelerating most recently with the advent of more genome-wide genomic analysis. And I should say, you know, here's the classic case of colon cancer. You start with some normal tissue, you get hits in certain genes, competitive advantage, and the tumor becomes more and more aberrant, ultimately leading to a metastatic phenotype here. And so, you know, shaped by a variety of selection processes, both the extrinsic environment and the things that are happening inside those tumors. But what is clear is that the system isn't as simple as that, where you have this sort of linear process, that you have over time whole, let's say, populations of cells in tumors which are completely being replaced by, you know, newer, more aggressive clones, and you have a kind of a holus bolus changing. And that became, you know, very clear from, you know, here's a nice case in a prostate cancer where people are able to laser capture microdissection of cells here, 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 and here. And if you look at the kind of losses that are present in some of these cells, you can see that cells over here just have this, you know, ERG gene, or these are unrearranged for ERG. These ones have P10 loss. These have a variety of other changes. And what you realize is here's a single tumor, and the cells over here are somewhat different than the cells over here. They're related. You know, they'll all have this particular fusion, but cells over here don't have a duplicated ERG gene, and they don't have a P10 where these ones do and this one doesn't. So, in other words, you actually have a complex genetic architecture of these tumors. And so you can imagine that instead of the simple process that Noel envisioned, what you have is a system where you know, if you start with normal tissue here, that over time you have, you know, a cancer which has a certain level of genetic load, but over time you can have independent evolution of additional alterations which are initiating and then persisting over time. And so you can imagine that if you were to sample this tumor over here, that the tumor actually represents a very complex types of genetic clones which are present in that tumor, becoming more and more aberrant. And so the question is, what's the problem with that model and what's the problem with this model? Well, the problem with the cancer stem cell model, or the hierarchy models, is that it doesn't, it, in its, let's say, simplest form, it tends to, as I sort of articulated, kind of view the tumor as being a genetically homogeneous entity. And you can imagine that, you know, what the way one proves a hierarchy is you can purify that population of cells from that population of cells. And you assume that these are genetically identical, and the only difference is this operation of this epigenetic program. But you can imagine that if I'm sampling a tumor here, and it's possible that these cells, which are very tumorigenic, and these cells are not particularly tumorigenic in my hypothetical transplant assay, it's possible when I separated cells, you know, in our, let's say, these cells are, you know, 133 positive, these cells are 133 negative, and I'm inferring that there's a hierarchy, but in fact it's just, I'm just isolating with my marker two different genetic types from that tumor. So that's the first problem. The second problem is, in again, in its rawest form, it tends to indicate that, you know, you have a cancer stem cell, and that's it. You have a certain number, and they're there, and they're doing whatever it is that they do. But it doesn't account for, you know, genetic variation, you know, diversity, and that it tends to be static. It doesn't account for the notion that you have this progression arising. Now, what's the problem with this model? Well, the problem with this model is it still doesn't account for the fact that within any one of these genetic clones, there could be epigenetic programs such that some cells are more potent than other cells. So it doesn't account, in a sense, for the presence of cells that have different function. I don't think that these necessarily need to be mutually exclusive. I think that with certain kinds of modifications, it's possible that you can actually unify these models. And so one idea is that, you know, when the tumor is present here, at least early on, it tends to reflect the tissue from which it's born. And if you're the blood, where you have a very strong kind of hierarchy, the tumor is essentially, you know, we know from some of the genetic hits that happen, for example, in AML, that what you have are hits in genes which affect differentiation. And so you essentially have a developmental system which isn't able to do it properly because there are breaks on those normal developmental systems. And so these cells can't develop down into becoming mature granulocytes because they have locks on, genetic locks, that prevent them from doing that program. But they're trying to do other steps in that program, and they're starting to do it, some of them normally and some of them abnormally. And so you can imagine then that you have a tumor system here, which is, you know, quite hierarchical, that there are relatively few, in our case, leukemia stem cells. They have a self-renewal, they behave like stem cells, and they make progeny that have lost that capacity. But this isn't a static system. These cells are also acquiring genetic alterations. And as they acquire more genetic alterations, what can happen? Well, what can happen is that you can get more and more breaks or locks, if you like, on development, so that the ability of these cells to mature is becoming more and more aberrant. The other thing that can happen is that these cells are self-renewing more, so that you get more stem cells. And ultimately, when you get enough genetic alterations, you have very little maturation going on, very high amount of self-renewal. And so one prediction of this is that, or several predictions, one is they're not static, they evolve, that genetic changes are influencing leukemia stem cell frequency from very low, very infrequent cancer stem cells to very high-frequent cancer stem cells. And so those are several predictions that one might imagine or expect if my hypothetical model is actually true. And so the question is there any evidence for this kind of a model? And I'll say one other thing. You know, we're now starting to see this massive, you know, tsunami, if you like, of genetic information. I've already articulated this from sort of a low-scale genetic analysis, but here's a recent paper from Tim Lay's group at WashU, where they've been able to do very genome-wide high-throughput or high-seq analysis of AML cells at diagnosis, and taking matched pairs of the same patient at relapse, and then determining which are the cells which are present at diagnosis are actually present at relapse. And one of the things that they're seeing here is that, first of all, in this particular sample that they looked at, there is four different subclones that are present at diagnosis in these patients. So just as deep static analysis has shown that there actually is not a homogeneous population of genetically identical cells. In fact, there are four minor clones. The dominant clone, which represents 50% of the cells, is over here. When they look at the relapse, what they can show is that the relapse didn't come from the dominant clone. The relapse is actually initiated from this clone, which only represented 5% of the diagnostic clone. Yet that was the bad actor, and it was then the precursor, which then acquired more alterations and then contributed to relapse over here. So this is very powerful analysis. The problem is that, A, if you just did your static analysis here, you wouldn't know which of these clones is actually the bad actor. Now, they could infer it because they had the relapse sample, but if a patient come into the clinic and they come in and you do deep sequencing and you say, you have four clones here, we don't know which is the one we should be focusing on. The other thing I'll say is, so what you need is essentially function. The question is, tumors are dynamic entities. So here's an example of that. And we know that in this tumor, cells are growing, cells are dying. And so a priori, you don't know when you do your laser micro dissection of that cell there versus that cell versus that cell there, whether those cells are actually important to that tumor, whether those are the cells that are actually sustaining that tumor for the long term, whether those are the cells that are actually going to die tomorrow. So a priori, a static genetic analysis is actually not sufficient to infer function, at least certainly from a formal sense. And so I would argue that the most important cell in a tumor is those cells, or are those cells, which are able to sustain long-term clonal growth, because those then become the unit of selection. We'll come back and talk about that in a moment. So my proposition is that what one wants to do is to do your deep cancer genomic analysis, but not just on bulk analysis, but you need to do it at the level of the important cell. And in our case, it's the cell that has this ability to sustain the tumor that we operationally assay based on its ability to pass the disease if we transplant it into mice. So this was the work we reported last year, just to go over it. we actually turned our attention away from AML towards ALL, partly because, first of all, we started these experiments before the genetic analysis on AML had come out, and work from the St. Jude group had basically done a deep analysis of ALL and looking at about 10 or 12 different driver mutations, and they're drivers because we know they're drivers based on chromosomal translocation. And what they were looking at were just using copy number aberration analysis, or copy number changes, gains and losses, at a very fine resolution. What are the regions, or what are the cooperating genes that are present with these driver mutations? And the one we focused on is BCR-ABL. It's a very poor prognosis disease. And what the Mulligan lab had shown was that BCR-ABL has a relatively limited number of cooperating genes, less than 10. And so genetically, it seemed to be a relatively simple, if you like, kind of tumor. Now, obviously, this isn't full genome sequencing, and there are obviously, there's many neutral mutations, I would imagine, in a tumor like this, and so there will be hundreds, if not mutations, but probably not very many drivers. We transplanted a bunch of these, which is a miserable project for the student who was working on this, because we had initially the cells wouldn't grow in the mice, and over those years we were working on this, we developed more refined ways of transplanting cells into mice. And once we did get at least some samples growing in mice, we realized that there was quite a variation, that when he looked after transplanting about 20, he realized that there was one set which actually seemed to grow quite aggressively, and it killed the animals by, you know, 10, 12 weeks. And there was another group which actually did grow in the mice, but it was, you know, more, let's say, indolent in the sense that it didn't kill the animals. So there were differences in the aggressiveness of the growth of these 20 samples. He was quite fastidious, and he did these so-called, you know, long-term or LTCIC assays, so these initiating assays. He did them quantitatively, and he was able to measure the frequency. And what he noted was, in the aggressive group, you had a much higher frequency of initiating cells compared to the non-aggressive group, by a factor of, you know, hundreds, if you like, and some of the thousands, if you like, in some of these cases. These two samples here, you know, for those people who talk about the unreliability of xenograft models, I mean, here are samples directly out of patients where the frequency in this sample here, I think, is about 1 in 30 or so. So very high frequency of initiating cells. So difference in aggressiveness, difference in LTCIC frequency. And so we had these samples, and so we collaborated with the Mulligan Lab, and so we did genome-wide copy number aberration analysis and just asked, what are the genetic changes that are present in the samples that we have? And one of the genes that they had identified in their set of about 50 or 60 samples was that whenever you're BCR-ABL ALL, 80% of the samples have deletions in Ikaros gene. And what we showed was that in our set of 20 samples, that it's about right, 80% of these samples have deletions in Ikaros, shown here. And it didn't change between the aggressive group and the non-aggressive group. But what did change, the other set of genes that they, or the other hit that they got in their original analysis was that in half of the samples, they had loss of CDKN2A, and the other half didn't have that. And we looked at our samples, and it turns out that, yes, we had about half of our samples ended up having a loss of CDKN2A. The regions are could be focal or they could be very large, but they have losses in CDKN2A. But here there was a complete restriction between the aggressive group had the CDKN2 deletions, whereas the non-aggressive group didn't. And that turns out, there's a paper just published, this we in our small set showed that this seemed to correlate with poorer survival in these patients, actually, not just aggressiveness in mice, but these patients had a little higher survival than these ones. And a group just reported this year on a set of about 200 or 300 patients that, in fact, CDKN2A is a poor risk in humans. And so it looks like our mouse model is actually predicting something which is actually relevant in the human situation. And then in some cases, this is on the same chromosome. This can extend it to PAX5, which is a master transcription factor important in lymphoid development. So what this essentially is saying is that genetics are changing the aggressiveness of growth of cells, and genetics are changing the frequency, or genetics are correlated with changes in frequency of leukemic initiating cells. So one of the propositions that we said should be there if we are able to unify, if you like, these hierarchy models and genetic models. Genetics are influencing these stem cell-like properties. And then the other thing that we went on to do is to say, all right, so not just looking at the samples that we put in, but what happens to the xenograft? What grows out in the mouse? You know, partly we were doing these experiments certainly when we started. We were just wanting to know whether this was going to be a good genetic model to test to study the disease. We can grow it, take a small sample, grow it out in mice. We can do drug testing. We do all kinds of analysis. And so we looked at six samples, and we showed by, again, we just did genome-wide analysis of multiple mice derived from a patient sample, and we showed that there was complete concordance in six of the samples. In other words, all the mice transplanted from six of these donors looked just like the patient sample. So that was kind of satisfying, looks like it's going to be a good model. The problem was that in the other six samples, what was growing out in the mice in the xenograft was actually somewhat different. It was related. It was BCR-ABL, and it had certain, you know, immunoglobulin rearrangements. So it was related, but it had acquired additional genetic alterations compared to the patient sample. And so this was a bit odd and a little disconcerting at the beginning. And here's an example. Here's the patient sample. Here's a deletion at this particular locus on chromosome 6. And you can see that all three xenografts actually have that deletion that's not present in the patient sample. And the level of sensitivity of the SNP analysis, or the genome-wide SNP chips that were used for this analysis, you know, is about, if you push it, maybe 5%. So So at least the level of detection here is that it's not present at the level of 5%. So the question is, what's going on? I mean, the possibility is that, you know, there's a de novo acquisition of these genetic alterations. You know, you take human cells, you put them in a mouse, stuff happens. You know, mousy things happen to those cells. You get selection processes, who knows what. The other option is it's an outgrowth of a pre-existing variant. That is, there's something that we don't see, but it's there, and for whatever reason, it has a competitive growth advantage. Now, the argument against this is that here is patient sample, 2 xenografts, patient sample, 4 xenografts, patient 2, etc. The fact that this is down to, you know, the single SNPs, almost single nucleotides, in 4 recipients tells us that this can't be the de novo acquisition, because you would expect each of these mice would be somewhat different. And this really argues strongly that this is the outgrowth of a pre-existing clone. It's also telling us then that it means that the clone, which is dominant in the patient, is not competed or is outcompeted by some kind of a minor clone that's present. So it's telling us that there are competitive growth differences of these different subclones that must be present in these diagnostic samples. I'll say these patients are all taken before they saw chemotherapy. They're just coming to the clinic, and these are the diagnostic samples. And so we went and looked at this in more detail and designed an experiment like this. So you can imagine a hypothetical situation where you have, you know, 4-5 clones here, you know, brown clones, green clones, blue clones, and red clones. And the green clones are the most aggressive guys. So if you take this whole gamish of tumor, put it into mice, the green clones are going to dominate because they're the aggressive ones. But the blue clones could be there, and if the green clones weren't there, you'd actually see them. And so one way to do this, to go back to our, you know, sort of stem cell biology 101, is to start to do clonal analysis, transplant single leukemic initiating cells into these mice. And let me just make one other point here. The fact that only leukemic initiating cells are actually able to pass the disease tells us that this genetic change is actually happening not just in any old cell, but it's actually happening at the level of leukemic initiating cells. And so the way to, you know, one sort of piece of evidence of that then was this limiting dilution experiment where we took transplanted single stem cells or single initiating cells into mice. And so this was an aggressive sample. Frequency of initiating cells is about 1 in 100. So we transplanted some mice with 1,000 cells. So by our stats, 10 stem cells. And then we transplanted a bunch of mice with 60 cells. And in this case, 2 out of 9 were actually engrafted. So, you know, statistically, by Poisson statistics, the 2 that were engrafted should have gotten only single initiating cells. And so then we did genetic analysis on the donor and then these various recipients. So you can see that the donor and the recipients are all related based on the immunoglobulin loci. So remember, this is a B-cell leukemia, so there's a single rearrangement, and that's passed through all of these. They're all BCR-ABLE. And you can see that this patient has a large hemizygous deletion around CDKN2A, and then a homozygous deletion right at CDKN2A. And you can see that the mouse that got 10 stem cells looks just like the patient donor. One of the mice that got a single stem cell also looks like the patient donor. But the other mouse that got a single stem cell has the hemizygous deletion, but not the homozygous deletion. And so it suggests that these cells are more aggressive than these cells are. That's one conclusion. The second conclusion is, that's a supposition, but the other conclusion, which is very strong, is because this is a deletion, it tells us that this clone that's lurking in the diagnostic sample in this patient is actually the ancestor clone. So in fact, in one pull of the needle, we've actually captured something about the evolutionary history, if you like, of that tumor. We've actually captured an ancestor clone, which must be the basis upon which the second deletion happened, the focal deletion here at CDKN2A. And so that's giving us some insight, you know, some stepping back in time into how this tumor actually got there. And if we do this in a deeper way, it's possible that we're actually able to backtrack, you know, closer to when that cell was back to being a normal one. So I think that's a very interesting sort of a strategy. And so that the beginnings of that are seen sort of in this. So here was this unusual sample which had a very complex set of genetics. There's the patient sample. Here are 5 different recipients. And without going through lots of detail, because I have other things to talk about, what became clear is that, first of all, we thought this was a big gamish until we started to put things in order and realized that what we're seeing here is essentially a very complex subclonal architecture which is very reminiscent of branching, the classical branching evolutionary processes that Darwin predicted that happens in sort of speciation. So these are clones which are evolving, and we don't quite know the direction of this arrow here. This is the dominant clone. But what you're seeing are cells that are branching off here and taking independent trajectories based on the genetics that they're developing. So this is interesting, of course, because we're able to begin to understand something about the evolutionary trajectory. But it also is very sobering, I think, for personalized medicine and sort of therapeutic development. Because I think I've said most of the things here that to unify these two models, I think we're now seeing that genetics, that the diversity is happening at the level of the LIC. We can reconstruct the genetic ancestry, and they are evolving in a very complex way. It's telling us that the diversity extends into the cells that we think are important to those tumors. That's the initiating cells, so the cells that have stem dysfunction. And they're not static, but they can evolve. But this is the problem. The problem is that these clones are evolving independently. They're requiring genetic alterations, which are not predicted by the dominant clone. So if you just do an analysis of the dominant clone and say, you have five mutations, and we're going to target, 3, 4, and 5 with these genes, it's possible the bad actor is not that guy. That guy's going to be treated perfectly fine, but there are these other clones which are evolving that don't have those alterations. They have something else. And so I would say that what we need to be thinking about is not personalized medicine, where we're thinking about giving the right patient the right drug based on what mutations we think we see, but it needs to be personalized at the clonal level. So personalized clonal medicine, where every clone in that patient actually needs to be targeted. The problem is that if those clones are present at frequencies of 1 in 10,000 or 1 in 50,000, even deep genetic analysis sequencing is not going to capture them. We need to come up with functional approaches, and perhaps growing these cells in mice is actually one approach to try to capture these kinds of cells. And this is where the problem comes in. So this is the analysis that Mulligan reported. It's a beautiful study where they had also done paired analysis of diagnostic and relapse samples across a set of ALLs. And what they showed was in about half of the cases, the relapse sample was directly related to the diagnostic sample. So it was either the same clone or the same clone which had acquired more and more alterations. But in fully half of the samples, the clone that came up at relapse was only distantly related and not directly related to the diagnostic clone. In fact, they inferred in that paper that there must be pre-existing ancestral clones from which these cells are arising. And the fact that we found them based on transplantation, I think, lends lots of support for their original hypothesis. So it's telling us that in the future we really need to carry out much more complex genetic analysis to try to understand this subclonal architecture of tumors. And I think that, in the context, I know that, a lot of people are interested in modeling cancer. I think that, these are very important principles that need to be built into the kind of models that need to be developed. Because, of course, these cells presumably are being shaped by different forces these ancestral clones are being shaped by different forces than the diagnostic clone. So let me just say it in a different way. Two things have to happen when a normal cell becomes cancerous, right? One is the internal wiring has to change. Cells have to dysregulate their growth, change their survival properties to some minimal level for them to become a cancer. But the other thing happens is that, the body has other systems to try to contain cancer, and that's called the immune system. And so cells have to not just acquire enough wiring to make them cancerous, but they also have to find ways of escaping the immune system before they become a dominant clone. And that becomes the clone that you see when you go into the doctor because you have a problem. But you can imagine that if there are, in the process of genetic changes that are arising, you could have cells that are arising which are changing their internal wiring, but they're not escaping the immune system. They're still being constrained by the immune system, but they're starting to take these independent trajectories down other pathways. Constrained by the immune system, so they don't become a dominant clone, but they're changing their wiring processes. And so now you come in, person comes into the clinic, and they get the therapy, which maybe is appropriate for the diagnostic clone, and that's perfectly fine. You get rid of that guy, but if these guys have changed their wiring in such a way that they survive those therapies, they can then, of course, regrow relapse. Now, what are we doing when we take you know, why is it that the dominant clone is only growing out in half of the samples, and the other half, it's not growing out, but somebody else is, right? If you go back to this little diagram I had at the very beginning here. Why is it that in half of the samples the dominant clone, but the other half it isn't? Well, we're growing them in a mouse that doesn't have an immune system. So we're removing, we're releasing, in a sense, the constraint of the immune system, and perhaps what we're doing is we're reading out the raw, latent, genetic dysregulation of these cells by growing them in a mouse. And so what we're seeing is that sort of latent bit, and perhaps that's why these guys, and we need to know whether these are the, you know, right now we've not formally proven that the things that are growing out in a mouse are the things that are directly related to what's been grown in the patient. So that's the study that we're doing now. But I think it's an interesting possibility. How much time do I have left? 5 seconds? Okay. I'll just touch then on the other, I think I've already sort of said this, that this is a nice review that Mel Greaves and Carlos Malley wrote a month or two ago. But, you know, one of the things I think that if one thinks of is that if the difference between a cancer stem cell and a non-cancer stem cell is quite distinct and quite rigid. In other words, if this arrow is quite broad and the back arrow is quite small, it really says then that the cancer stem cell, the cell that has stemness or self-renewal properties or clonal maintenance properties, becomes the unit of selection for that tumor. It's really then, if that's true, then it's the property of those cells that are actually most relevant to that tumor. And that becomes a testable hypothesis. Now, you can imagine that there are other tumors where the back arrow here becomes a bigger arrow for other reasons, because of the effect of the extrinsic environment. I think you're probably going to hear work like this from Senderai, where, you know, extrinsic influences can change these arrows based on, you know, EMT and other kinds of things. But at least in tumors where there's a fairly strong hierarchy here, that becomes the question. And so that becomes a testable hypothesis. So if this cell is a real cell and it's the unit of selection, its properties should be more predictive of outcome and ultimately patient survival than the signatures or properties of these cells here. And that becomes testable. And so that's what we did. We basically took a set of 16 AMLs, fractionated it into the best markers that we had available at the time. And we didn't just rely on flow cytometry in the literature to say stem cells are here and we should bioinformatically compare this to this to find signatures which are unique here. We actually went and actually tested all of these fractions from all of these samples in mice and validated where the leukemia stem cells were. And that turned out to be an important thing because with more optimized assays, we actually found cancer stem cells in other places, not just here. Here, exclusively in some samples, here and here in many samples, and occasionally here and here, or here and here. And so if you didn't know that, you'd be bioinformatically comparing apples and apples when what you want to do is compare apples and oranges, stem cells and non-stem cells. And I'll say that in about another 2 months, we'll have data starting to emerge from 100 samples. So we've spent a large amount of money and many, many hundreds of mice to do these experiments by doing this in some kind of a quantitative way to get a much deeper signature. And so anyway, we ended up getting a gene list that was affiliated with leukemia stem cells, distinct from the non-cancer stem cells, did a lot of bioinformatics. Then we asked, is it relevant? And so it turns out that there was clinical data where people had captured on 160, in this case, AML samples, where they had captured gene expression signatures, but they had also provided a lot of clinical correlative data, including survival. And so we just asked the very simple question, if we have these 160 samples, is our leukemia stem cell signature, first of all, persistent in just bulk cells? So that's the one question. And if it is, does it vary across those 160 samples? And so this was our 42 gene signature. Here's 160 samples. You can see that it was high in some patient samples and it was low in other patient samples. So it was present and it did vary. And the question is, does it correlate with anything with survival? Because we knew survival outcome from all these samples. And it turns out the answer is that it did. So if you have a low signature, you do much better than if you have a high signature. And you can see the statisticians love this. There's six zeros in front of the p-value. It's a very strong predictor. In fact, it's probably the strongest predictor in AML for survival outcome. And in fact, if you look at other signatures that came up in other ways, there's actually good correlation with this stem cell signature. In other words, the reason that other genetic signatures are predictive is because they actually relate to this stemness signature. Now, the reason we call it a stemness signature is we ended up getting this data because at the same time we have been generating a leukemia stem cell signature, we've generated a normal HSC signature in exactly the same way. And that also was predictive, one less zero in front of the p-value. And when we did gene set enrichment between these LSC signatures, we asked, what did they look like? Well, it turns out that LSC don't look like normal progenitors. There's no correlation, you see, from this gene set enrichment analysis. It doesn't look like ES cells. But in fact, what it does look like is normal HSCs. In other words, the fact that you get this very high enrichment of our signature within the HSC signature tells us that they seem to be conserved. And if you look at this core signature, that is highly, highly predictive of survival. And so it's looking like it's not just that LSCs are correlating with survival, but it's actually the parts of their signature which are the determinants of stemness that are actually driving that survival prognostic outcome. And you know, based on the mouse, we know that some of the genes in here, in fact, are genes which are well known to be regulators of stem cells, and we're obviously doing a lot of work to try to test the other ones to see how they actually impact on stem cell function or whether they do or not. Is this relevant or not? Well, so AML is, you know, one of those nasty diseases, and sorry, one of the only ways that people have to try to give people differing therapies is, so I'm going to step back. So AML, you can drive therapy based on markers. The problem is that in 40% of AMLs, they're cytogenetically normal. In other words, they don't have a translocation. And so people have tried to develop mutational risk stratifiers and develop this one. If you have that kind of architecture, those kind of mutations or not, you have low molecular risk, if you have high molecular risk, you're that. And if you're high molecular risk, you're offered transplantation. So very toxic therapy, but the only hope of survival for these patients. Now, because it's so toxic, you wouldn't want to offer it to patients who you would call low molecular risk. But the problem is, this is not a particularly good risk stratifier because probably 40% of these patients actually will relapse early. And so we asked, of the samples we looked at, do the patients who have low molecular risk, do they vary in their signature? So we just look at the red arrows here. So it turns out you can find patients who are low molecular risk based on those two mutations, and you have some of those have a high signature and some of those have a low signature. And if you look at the survival outcomes, those that have a low signature do much better than those that have a high signature. And if you have that arrow should be there. But if you have a high signature, you do just as badly as the high molecular risk. So if that's true, this is a small sample size, and we're actually now in the process of validating this. But if this is true, this becomes an important new stratifier because that should be applied to this, because it means that those patients who have a high signature here, who have a low molecular risk, should actually be offered transplantation as a possible way of increasing their survival. And so this is an example, I think, of where these stemness signatures actually might be valuable for future therapeutic development. And essentially they're saying that, you know, genetics isn't everything. You know, these 160 samples have a diverse set of genetics, and yet they seem to distill down into one sort of stemness signature that seems to be predictive. And so, So I think in the interest of time, I'm going to stop at that point and just simply say that I think that our understanding of the heterogeneity of tumors is becoming, you know, there's much more appreciation of the diversity of cells. You know, tumors aren't just homogeneous entities that, you know, you can sort of whack out, mash up, and do proteomics, genomics, and biochemistry. And I think, you know, that's brought us a long ways in the last three or four decades. But we're now at the point of knowing that in addition to, you know, genetic diversity, which we're started talking about here, there's this functional diversity based on, you know, tumor initiation and other epigenetic programs. We know tumors aren't just tumor cells. They have infiltrating microenvironmental influences. And so there's going to be a lot of diversity within those cells that we need to now take account of. And that what that really is telling us, I think, for the future is we need to begin to essentially reduce everything we know about the biology of cancer down to single cells. So I think once we're able to carry out single cell proteomic analysis, single-cell genomic analysis, single-cell biochemical analysis, is where we need to go to begin to untangle, if you like, this complex behavior or property of tumor cells. So thanks very much for your attention.